Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland, made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Meat and Three is Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you highlights from Feast Portland, like our chat with the one and only Andrew Zimmern.
I'm super excited to be here because for people who do what I do for a living, we do tons of, you know, desk side chats and podcasts and interviews and stuff like that. And you circle the handful of ones in a year where you get to talk with people that you're really excited about talking with. So this is awesome.
We picked up on some recurring themes while talking to our impressive roster of guests, including the current state of Portland's food scene, personal identity, and believe it or not, the influence of great chefs' grandmothers.
Meemaw never touched a drop of booze in her life and now has a distillery named after her. But I grew up in her garden and just really, she taught me all good things come from scratch and women can be anyone they want to be.
So tune in for this week's extra special episode. Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, and welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, having a very civilized day here today with Edward Fraunader, better known as, is it Eddie or Edie?
It's Eddie.
Eddie and the Wolf is a wonderful restaurant in New York City's Alphabet City, kind of East Village area, and you own a few more, which are all Austrian or Viennese themed, because you are an Austrian man, born and raised in Vienna, which I've been to before, and it's a fascinating city because of how preserved it is. You know, it went through a couple world wars, but it was untouched, and around the Ringstrasse, there's so much culture and history, and it has this long lineage and legacy, but it doesn't feel old and stodgy. It feels like new and really inviting in some crazy, crazy way. Do you feel about Vienna in that same fashion?
I mean, I am from Vienna. I grew up there, and I moved to the U.S. when I was 21. So, like, I think my formative years, being young at least for American standards, was in Vienna. And I do agree with you. Vienna feels a little bit timeless because it's a grand city. It used to be the capital of a two-thirds of Europe, half of Europe, 26 nations and languages combined in the Habsburg Empire. So, and this city was by design for a way bigger population than what it is today. And hence the grandeur of the Ringstrasse and the buildings, the history those walls have seen, and the entire footprint of the city as well. And then, because you mentioned Austrian cuisine, it's also one of the few city-based cuisines in the world. Because you have the French cuisine, you have Italian cuisine. Yes, there's sub-branches to it. You've got the Provence in southern France, etc. But like this, I think there's more the Viennese cuisine than the actual Austrian.
Yeah, let's define that because I've been to Austria and I've been down to Styria, into Graz, and that
beautiful.
It's stunning, and they're amazing orchard fruits and, you know, thermal baths. But it feels like a completely different place than Vienna does. But what would you constitute as Austrian cuisine? What are the classic dishes, and does any of that trickle down into Vienna, or is that something of its own?
I mean, I think Austrian cuisine is defined by the Viennese cuisine itself. It's not just the capital, but it's also like it was always the area where the aristocracy could afford to play with food. Let's be frank. Like until I love history of food until like the 19th century, even like the very first part of the 20th century. What was the driving force of any culinary development? That was the courts. That was the courts of Europe, which basically brought poor man's ingredients / food, and then exchange it within one another. Like they would change shifts. They would like bring ingredients from other countries, spices, salts, coffee, this, that, chocolate, and so on and so forth. So so Vienna was always the melting pot for Austria, and the Viennese cuisine was always equal to the Austrian cuisine, and there basically the main dishes developed, meaning the Wiener Schnitzel, which was landed from the La Cotoletta alla Milanese from the court of Milan, but then of course refined, bone taken off, because it's not a cotoletta, it's just a piece, but it's only a piece of meat pounded, so you do not have the bone on it. And then on the other hand, through the reduction of the bone and just the meat, you can like really define it through cooking it perfectly, like that puffiness, what you want in the Wiener Schnitzel, that being one dish. Then the next dish would be the goulash, which was lent by the Hungarians, and then defined through like the usage of the veal cheek and like lesser elegant cuts of the beef. But we do have to use all parts, because nose to tail cooking is nothing new. Nose to tail cooking has been around as long as we have been breeding animals, and So it always amuses me, like how in what 360 degree cycle those trends go. Same with like seasonal cooking. I mean, there was only seasonal cooking until 60, 70 years ago. So like when did we lose that? And then we have to re-find it.
You know what's fascinating about Vienna is that there are some aspects that aren't seasonal at all. And one specific thing is the coffee house culture there. And in the coffee houses, it's egalitarian. It's not aristocratic. I feel like anyone could go there, enjoy a Wiener melange, like the cappuccino, have a slice of Sacher Torte. Mm-hmm. And there is always that on the menu. So it isn't a seasonal thing. It's an expected and very comforting thing that it's always there.
Oh, the coffee shop itself has not only a very egalitarian spirit. I mean, the coffee shop most likely and most importantly had a sheltering function as well, because people did not have heat. So they had to go to the coffee shop basically to enjoy a warm room for numerous hours a day, and whole revolutions were planned in coffee shops.
Literally body heat.
Body heat, but also they had a chimney most of the time. So body heat plus the heat off the kitchen, plus the chimney, because people did not have always enough fire to keep the house warm during the day.
So I should never go to Café Lantmann and say, oh, it's too hot in here, because I'm taking for granted the fact that there is heat.
Well, believe it or not, one trivial story about Café Lantmann, which is located right across the parliament.
Yeah.
I think they were so afraid what the waiter heard over all those years working there, they actually gave him a Medal of Honor. Yes, believe it or not, they gave the waiter of the Lantmann, who worked there for like 20 plus years, 30 plus years, a Medal of Honor for all the sketchy things he probably heard from the politicians.
Well, let's talk about this Café Lantmann, because we are in the city of Freud, and it was a very known haunt for him and psychoanalysis of mm-hmm. his time. What does that mean in the greater context of Vienna, but also food culture in Vienna?
I mean, Lantmann, like the Viennese coffee shop, Lantmann more specifically, is like the Viennese version of a French bistro. You have like breakfast, lunch, dinner, late night drinks, this, that. People had their tabs running because either they didn't want to pay or they couldn't pay, and it's a concept. It's a gastronomical concept which I think is harder and harder to execute in days of today, given things have to be fast, things have to be easy, not too refined, but at the same time they have to be understood, and so Lantmann, like any old Viennese coffee shop who's still in business today, and there was a big consolidation of coffee shops, is fueled through tourism. And just like areas getting better and better, people have more, having like, again, more time to spend then and use them as meeting places.
you know, viennoiserie is that meeting place between bread and pastry.
Absolutely.
And this may blow people's
minds. I grew
up
in a bakery.
Oh, really?
I grew up in a bakery and a coffee shop. I was before I was a chef, I was a trained baker.
Yeah. And it is this amazing kind of intersection of those two things. And a lot of people might not know that the croissant is...
It's Turkish.
Know, well, and then through
they
left, Austria.
They forgot it. They actually, when Vienna stopped the Turks twice, the Ottoman Empire, not the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, and after their retreat, they found two things, two major things, which was coffee and then a half moon shaped pastry, which that's the reason why the croissant is half moon shaped. And then this viennoiserie, full circle, went then back to the court of France through that connection to be then implemented as the croissant in France and in Paris.
Yeah, and it was cultivated in this wonderful way in Austria, in Vienna, and in these coffee houses. And do you find that same education has to go into something like, you know, a Wiener Schnitzel? I mean, it's nothing but a fried cutlet of meat that's breaded, but it seems like something else. It seems, you know, foreign. In the concept of being here in New York and having Wiener Schnitzel, it feels transportive to Vienna. Do you have to educate people what that dish is?
And what seems very simple to food-obsessed people is at times very hard for somebody who has not been around, number one, not that long, meaning like seniority and like just like age spent in a kitchen, or B, also interest. I know people who like very. I know some of my chefs are very, very young, but they're so into it. They absorb things like sponges, like little kids, and they make a schnitzel after like three times. They just like bang it out of the park, and it puffs perfectly. And like the way they treat their flour, their eggs, their breadcrumbs, the way they pound it, how uniform, and so on and so forth. It's just like perfect. And it comes very intuitive. And for some people, it does not come very intuitive. But that's with a lot of things. It's like you being a radio host, like perfect. They're like the intonation, the breaks. It's like a theater. And for some people, it's very easy to like be part of that theater. And for others, it's a lifelong struggle. And then you should not be, I guess, in the kitchen, or you keep on trying. But there's also one beautiful thing about repetition. It makes it, you can make it better and better every time you make it. Every time you make it, you can improve. And that's what I think cooking or a lot of tasks are. Like you are a pro tennis player. There's like four or five different strokes, and you repeat them how many thousands of times until it's perfect, and only a subsequent level of perfection leads to the grand slam, so to say. So
well, on that, we're going to take a quick break and come back and maybe talk about the grand slam of Viennese cuisine, schnitzel, spatzel, strudel, and maybe schnapps,
because
you have to finish a meal with something.
We have to.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of the Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kaltbach Cave Age cheeses, Der Scharfe Max, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org, here today with Eddie Fraunader. And we were talking about Viennese cuisine and brought up schnitzel, spatzel, strudel, and schnapps, the four S's. There are so many interesting and intricate things that happen in Viennese cuisine that are very simple dishes. We were talking about the difference between aristocratic and egalitarian, but really these are very simple, made at home, but also made at restaurant dishes. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like there's a separation in a lot of these foods.
I mean, yes and no. It's also it's a level of execution. I mean, like when I opened Seasonal and we received a Michelin star after 6 months, we did have Spätzle and the Schnitzel and the goulash on the menu. It's all a question of execution. And like, it's really difficult to reinvent food because the best foods come from the street, from the peasant, from the rural area where people like really know how to go with the season. People know how to treat certain vegetables, proteins, this, that, and the other. So yes, you can say most cooking is simple, but like I think to keep all those moving parts together in the kitchen is the art of, I guess, kitchen management, or just like producing a beautiful dish to order and also like prepping it a certain way. And it's very simple. I mean, like I think as long as it's fresh seasonal ingredients, well treated and well sourced, that's the first step. But I think it's also one of the most important steps. And like the rest is I guess the art of cooking and the proper execution. But like I know to the outsider, Austrian food can come across as being like overly simplistic, and like they always think it's only meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
And like, you know what, meat and potatoes can be very, very wonderful and very, very soothing. And Wiener Schnitzel is ultimately meat and potatoes. But I don't know a single person who came back from Austria and said not how happy they were with the food. And thank God all my restaurants in New York City, because people are well traveled, you don't have to explain to them anymore.
Yeah,
the schnitzel, the spätzle, the goulash, and so forth.
Well, coming back from Vienna, the first thing that I wanted to find was a good schnitzel. And I went to Fiegelmüller in Vienna and had their schnitzel, and it's you know, bigger than
childhood memories. Yeah. I have childhood memories from the size and the taste of that schnitzel, and they have this raspberry soda. I don't know if you had.
No,
it.
I didn't.
I'm telling you, they have this raspberry soda, and my father used to take us there, my brother, my sister, and me. And I can remember it till today. I do not remember the schnitzel, but I remember this raspberry soda.
Well, then going to Schilling, your newest restaurant in the financial district, having that schnitzel brought me back there in a way, because I've been looking for the schnitzel that has waves. Mm-hmm. And I've been watching these mesmerizing videos of you making schnitzel, yeah. The butterfly cut, pounding it out. But there is a technique in dragging the meat, you know, the breaded cutlet through the oil so it swims rather than sinks, so you don't burn a side of it.
Well, it's a multifold process, as most things in life are. You first start with the pristine cut of meat. Can be chicken, can be veal, can be pork, center cut pork loin, veal top round, or chicken breast. And then you basically you cut it to a quarter of a half inch piece, and then you basically pound it. The pounding is a tenderization process, which really helps in the subsequent eating and in the evenly cooking of the schnitzel. Because don't forget, like the quality of people's teeth 100 years ago was awful. And like they were not neither aging it nor braising it. Like, you just don't forget that this black piece of meat had to be perfect in order to be like eaten easily. And then you basically use sifted all-purpose flour, slightly lightly beaten whole egg with nothing. Some people like swear putting in sparkling water. Some swear putting in milk. No, egg only, slightly beaten. The reason why you only want it lightly beaten is so it coats a bit thicker on the schnitzel, and then you basically finish it off in breadcrumbs, sifted, unseasoned breadcrumbs. Don't use any like seasoned herbal breadcrumbs. It just like takes flavor away from the actual meat, which is the star of the dish. And after going through this breading procedure, and just make sure that like you have no like clumps forming in the breading procedure, because only an even coating of the meat will allow you to perfectly puff it up, which is then the key part, the puffed up schnitzel and the color, which has to resemble the color of a Stradivarius, going back to like the Viennese roots of classical music. And then the classic side dishes are fingerling potato salad, cucumber dill. Like, I think dill is such an underperformed and underused and utilized herb in cooking in general, together with tarragon, together with chevrol. I think those are like the three underdogs, I think, because everybody goes rosemary, thyme, parsley, chive. And I really think tarragon, chevrol, dill are the main stars. Yeah. I personally
think. The lighter, the softer herbs. And I agree, because after coming back from Vienna, I did crave dill. I had it in aquavit over there. I had it in so many different applications. I had it in schnapps. But spätzle, strudel, again, feel like these dishes that are so easily executed at home, but obviously it takes a very deft hand to be able to accomplish, you know, the lightness of what these things should be. There's this word, and I'm not going to be able to pronounce it, but it means a sense of conviviality.
Gemütlichkeit.
Yeah, can you explain what that comes from, what that means to you and to your restaurants?
I mean, some people call us crazy to put so much detail into the restaurants. I mean, if you look at Eddie and the Wolf, if you look at Freud, if you look at Schilling and The Third Man, there's a lot of like, there's this, first and foremost, the perfect sense of proportion. That's like also like what you really find in this, it's called the architectural stream, which Vienna is built on, is called the historismus. Historism, I guess, would be the proper translation to this. And historism basically the basis of the golden cut, which is from, I guess, Plato, mm-hmm. which basically defines a certain proportion within a room, within a building, within furniture, and so on and so forth. So this is the first rule what we have is the proportion of the room, bar versus dining room. When it comes to dining room, seating versus the width of the place, etc. And then, so gemütlichkeit starts with the proper proportion of a room, because only then you feel comfortable. The second you feel comfortable, you can start with sharing this time with your friends, with your family. I mean, that's like the whole purpose of going to a restaurant, bar, whatever it is, coffee shop, is to refresh your memories from like good old times, create new good memories with either old friends and new friends, and ideally doing this together. Therefore creating this like self-feeding process of living, of life, of like, that's the reason why people lived in coffee shops.
You don't think it's because you want to set this sense of comfort and serenity so you can be psychoanalyzed? I mean, isn't that the basis of all Viennese culture?
Yeah, I mean, like,
you have a bar Freud.
There was a reason why Freud took Vienna as a, like, the breeding ground of his psychoanalysis, because number one, it was the center of, I guess, it was the scientific, the business center, the political center of the world at that time, and Freud, going back, I mean, like half New Yorkers are Freudians anyway, and three quarters go to the therapist. So, but then the Viennese had a different solution, which just like would sit with their friends, drink and talk. So that was their therapy. And like, if you really think about it, there's not much difference of paying your therapist to talk about certain things, or like going into the coffee shop or into a wine bar, a Viennese wine bar, to talk about the daily struggles you have, because for most we all have the same problems most of the time.
You know, in walking into The Third Man for the first time, I had this weird sense of deja vu, because I've seen the movie. Mm-hmm. I've seen Orson Welles, and it was written by Graham Greene, I believe, yes. Too.
Orson Welles just stars in it.
Yeah.
Some people think that it's
his movie.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, talk about psychoanalysis. It is a psychological thriller. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, walking into The Third Man, which is a little labyrinth-like, and you may feel trapped when you go in because of how it's set up, you feel fine being stuck there or staying there for a long period of time. How did you figure out the golden mean, or Plato's theory, in making that place so homey and so comfortable? And it just lets your guard down in this way.
I mean, it's the entire room basically mirrors itself, and it's the inspiration for the Third Man also came from this beautiful bar, which is the Loos Bar, LOOS in Vienna, which was built by Adolf Loos for his who was a grand architect for his three sons, because he was really irritated by his three sons always going out to drink at night. So he's like, listen, boys, I'm gonna build you a bar, which was right below where he lived, so I know where you are and you can feel comfortable. And this room is so small and makes such good use of proportion, mirrors, material, the brass, the green leather, the onyx, and so on and so forth. I mean, and this was built, if you go online and you check out this bar, you cannot believe that this bar is older than 100 years. So you have all this like speakeasy operations, and then this guy basically started with the elegant speakeasy 100 years ago. So that was the starting point to the Third Man.
Yeah.
And then when I told my guys, it's like, hey, I really want to build it like this, they gave me a dollar amount to build it like one-to-one, which was just not feasible. Like, I'm talking backlit marble, brass, leather, like infinity mirrors, which have to be like set up so in 90 degree angle that they work, and so on and so forth. And plus they had an Egon Schiele hanging in the corner.
Yeah.
Which the Schiele then really broke the bank.
Yeah. But walking into that space, again, it feels so inviting. And this mirror, this, you know, having so much reflection in there is certainly allegory to all the Freudian things that may happen. And I won't ask about your relationship with your mother, but I will ask...
She's coming in a week, so that's good.
I will ask about Heuriger's, though.
Yeah.
And this relationship Austrians and Viennese have with being outdoors and drinking and that conviviality. And when I walked up to Schilling, which is in the middle of the financial district, and it's unexpected that it's even there in what looks like an old tenement building.
One of the few tenement buildings which were left in all this like development craze before and after 9/11.
But it feels like a place where you can get away within the city. And Heurigers are similar in that fashion.
I mean, the Heuriger, which is basically the Viennese wine bar. There's, of course, people love it because like weather in Vienna can be very crappy, and those like 3, 4, 5 months out of the year, you really enjoy sitting there. Number one, number two, Austria produces only half the wine Germany produces, being the 1/10 of the population. That just shows how important wine is to the Austrian people. The Heuriger is also the wine equivalent to the beer garden. Very egalitarian. Everybody sits on big, long tables. At Schilling, we have like one big table holding 24. And people do share because they have no choice. They have to share it. And this, like, I tried to bring at Schilling this like airiness into the room by like getting rid of all ceiling height, like totally opening it up, 12-foot ceilings, and putting this like beautiful like bluish tones into the room. So basically like trying to like give you the idea of like you're sitting outside. And then the Heuriger also like really produces like very simple, straightforward, delicious food, which is, I think, the key to any restaurant today is like just keep it delicious, keep it simple, make food people can understand, and like be truthful to what you offer. And I know at Schilling we stretch it at times, because Schilling is also like a little bit our little Italian sibling. I took Trieste as an inspiration of the menu, and doing really, really well. And I think like the financial district is a very underserved neighborhood, and this is like also like a very quiet, nice block where you would not expect a restaurant such as Schilling.
Say this word again for me, the conviviality word.
Die Gemütlichkeit.
So it's defined as a sense of conviviality and cozy intimacy that comes from the temporary surrender of everyday responsibilities. And I love that. The temporary surrender of everyday responsibilities. And you've done that to me today by ordering this bottle of rosé and just coming here with this wonderful attitude that, you know, you are a very accomplished chef. You have very great restaurants and you do take business seriously, but you do not take life as seriously.
What's the most important thing we have in life? And I do not say this as a platitude. I say this because, number one, I just had my second child 3 weeks ago. And then I really like, I have to like, you always, we get caught up in this tunnel vision. Like we are like, you and I, we are people who love what we do. We strongly identify with the things we love and the things we produce and the things we touch and the things we move. And at the end of the day, you get like, we get at times carried away from the really important things in life, which is number one, we should be thankful that we're healthy. My wife is a surgeon. She's a breast cancer surgeon. So like she's like, that's tough. I mean, with us, it's not about life and death. We don't tell people. But with 80% of the time, she has good news for them. But the 20% is that those are tough conversations. This is a tough pill to swallow. But then on the other hand, I think like, hey, we've got our health. We've got our passion. We've got people we can share this with. And we've got a healthy family. So this is the core, what makes me function in everything else I do. And that's, I think that's, and then to be brought back from a Freudian standpoint, to like lose that tunnel vision at times, that there's more, a lot of beautiful things around us. And you don't have to be rich. You have to be financially independent to a certain extent that you like want, that you have the things you need. As long as you have health and like a healthy environment around you, meaning the coffee shop or the wine bar or God knows where you find your serenity, is I think the most important things what I'm striving for, like at my age at this point, because I gave so many things up for the past 16 years, just like sacrificing everything for that Michelin star, that New York Times review, that New York Magazine review, that feature in the wallpaper, that visit at Heritage Radio in New York City at Roberta's, yeah. And you have to get to the point in your life where you say, yes, you do this, but then you do that, and you have to be also a family man, and you have to be a leader, most importantly, in like in what you do. And I work with a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds, and like it's really to like to spark that flame of like what do you think is important when it comes to food, and it's food in general, it's not even Austrian food. I mean, it's like, it's all French technique. And then we can debate of like where this French technique is going to bring us, how abstract we want to take it. But ultimately, it's about hospitality. It's about the love of cooking, the love for the product, make the product shine. Don't think too complicated. And then while you're in this process, you will find your Gemütlichkeit. And then once you have found it as a restaurateur, waiter, cook, etc., you will bring that feeling of Gemütlichkeit to your guest, to your client, to your coworkers, to your family, which is Gemütlichkeit is applicable on all aspects of life, not just restaurants.
To your schnitzel.
To my schnitzel.
And on that, I will never look at a pounded, breaded, deep fried piece of meat, you know, in the same perspective again. And everyone should go to Eddie and the Wolf, Bar Freud, the Third Room, Schilling. Stop by Third Man, Schilling, and all these places and really see that, you know, there's so much perspective to be had on such simple things in life. But I thank you for being the person that you are and for having the restaurants that you do here in New York and bringing the serenity that we all need.
And Michael, thank you for the appreciation of Austrian cuisine. And listen, like it's the more the merrier. Thank you.
Excellent. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. A big thank you for the music by Cookies and David Tadashore Engineering. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.